Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome back to Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn, laugh, and meet people from different and diverse communities all over Ireland, where we hear their stories and perspectives and ultimately unify across our differences. I'm your host, Momobo Ogoro, and you can get in touch with us at unified@newstalk.com. That's unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, our panel will discuss, can bias in AI amplify existing inequalities? We'll meet South African poet Nandi Jola, who reflects on identity and migration in her writing. And we'll hear about Dublin's new cycling club for LGBTQ plus members and allies. But first, folks, anybody who knows me, they know that I am obsessed with AI. I'm obsessed with Claude. It is my second brain at this point. But for a lot of us, we don't see the repercussions of this whole AI revolution that we're in. And today I am joined by Dr. Abiba Birhani and Dr. Maria Murphy, who's going to talk about how AI actually can actually replicate inequalities in our society as well. So welcome, folks. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. So, Dr. Abiba, when it comes to AI, how does it actually work?
Yeah, great question. So, AI systems, well, first of all, what often passes as AI system is a broad collection of technologies and tools that often are that go under the broad umbrella of AI. So, game playing systems like AlphaGo and protein structure predictors like AlphaFold, even recommender systems that put forward, that curate feeds on your Instagram or your TikTok, even search engines. These are all powered by AI. Even consumer facing products like, you know, agentic AI or AI companions, they are all under they all go under the broad umbrella of AI. And sometimes even just very simplistic kind of regression models that do kind of, you know, matching and classification, they are also considered as AI systems. So AI is a broad set of technologies. And most of the way AI works is that training data sets are the backbone of AI systems. We are having the AI revolution now over the past decade or so, not because we have new revolutionary AI techniques. It's because over the past 20 years, we have had the internet and we are able to gather massive amounts of data to train AI systems. So training data, which we require lots and lots, trillions of tokens, for example, to train systems like ChatGPT, is the backbone, the most necessary element of AI systems. So
we are the backbone of AI.
Yeah, exactly. So any content we put out, whether it's, you know, our kids, images, or any textual exchange as we participate in various online forums, all that is harvested. Any daily transaction you have, you know, that is data that's constantly harvested and used to train AI systems. And one rule of thumb is that no matter how diverse the AI system you are looking at, one rule of thumb is that AI systems are as good as the training data. And most of the data, most of the training data, because it comes from the internet, and the internet tends to kind of, you know, preserve and reflect, you know, society's ugliness, but also beauties and nastiness, what you get is that AI systems that encode societal norms and societal biases, prejudices and discriminations and so on. And we all know that society hasn't been kind to, you know, the most marginalized, whether it's in terms of sexuality, ability or gender or race and so on. So oftentimes, I mean, not oftentimes, all the time, any AI system, unless it's actively, you know, corrected, all AI systems tend to then encode and sometimes exaggerate and exacerbate these existing societal norms.
That's crazy, because you would think, and a lot of people use these AI models to get information and to get support and to, for me, myself included, my second brain. Maria, how does that actually, like, as to what Dr. Abiba was saying, how does that add to the inequalities of society as well as we start to implicate or use AI systems for our everyday life?
I think what you said about the second brain is so on point, and in many ways is one of the major concerns with these systems being more readily adopted and used. It's very, very attractive to use these systems because not only does it kind of sound like you're speaking to an informed third party, a colleague, without the hassle of actually speaking to another person, it kind of cognitively offloads some of the work. It can assist our workflow. It can help us break the blank page at times in a way that can seem extremely helpful. And of course, there can be ways in which this can expedite processes and assist us in our decision making. But real concern arises when we have our inherent human bias to somewhat do what the computer says, to believe the computer as this objective determiner of truth. And as a result, we can make decisions without appropriately querying all the biases and challenges that she's raised due to not just the historical data sets, but the training methods, the labelers, all the other ways in which bias can be introduced into the system.
That's kind of scary, no? And how does it, like, as you said, Abiba, how does it affect the most marginalized in society?
Yeah, great question. I think I tend to focus on, individual uses are mm-hmm. really difficult to study and they vary. But what worries me the most is institutional adoption of AI. Mm. So we are seeing AI, especially generative AI, being adopted in, you know, education for the in the teaching learning process. More and more organizations are using AI systems in recruitment to kind of match CVs and to decide which candidate is the most suitable, the most appropriate in social welfare decision making, in law enforcement, in medication, in healthcare, in hospitals. Basically, everywhere we are seeing massive adoption of AI systems. And what worries me is that as we are, you know, adopting these systems in these various domains, we are kind of really also bringing in these very nuanced biases. For example, there is plenty of research that shows that, again, people at the margins of society tend to be disproportionately negatively impacted. If you look at the example of hiring, for example, just citing one of the work that came out last year where investigative journalists audited ChatGPT in the setting of hiring, where they have about 8 exactly the same CVs, and the only difference is the name. So some of the names are, you know, Western white sounding names, some of them are immigrant sounding names, the gender also, some of them are males, others are female, you know, racial backgrounds as well. They had 4 groups: Black, Hispanic, Asian, and white men. And what they found was that ChatGPT allocated jobs like engineer, judge, CEO, doctor, and politician, lawyer, architect highly to mostly white men, whereas jobs such as social worker, housekeeper, teacher, cashier were mostly allocated to Black women and Hispanic women.
Wow.
So this is one of the clear examples where you see that you know, the societal nuances really seep into the system we adopt. And there's been plenty of research, whether it's in hiring, whether it's in healthcare, you know, research has been coming out showing the same thing time and time again, that people that are excluded from various services, whether it's medical care or, you know, social welfare benefits, tend to be, again, people that are at the margins of society.
And that's pretty scary, if that research study that you mentioned there, in terms of, like, we just use it for and we think it's going to make the process easier, better, like what Maria was saying. But when it comes to the actual outcomes for certain communities, it's just replicating what the human biases that are already exist. And I suppose these massive institutions that are adopting these AI models, or these AI in general, what kind of guardrails, Maria, can we put into place, or are there guardrails being put into place? What is Ireland doing? What is the EU doing? It just seems like a lot.
It certainly is. And there are, of course, efforts, some very high profile efforts, both, you know, in Europe and in Ireland, and there is guidelines internationally. But I think something to point out, which I think, you know, builds on that point about how we do have so much evidence about the various biases that exist, is the need to challenge is actually so critical to ensure that rights are actually protected and that harms are mediated. But so often with these systems, it can be quite difficult to determine when issues have arisen. There is, of course, work out there, and there's methods of enhancing accountability and transparency of these systems. But so often, we don't actually know when errors have occurred within these systems, when the biases have arisen, and they can be really quite immensely difficult to challenge in practice. And so, going back a long way, we've had some legal protections against automated decision making in Europe under the General Data Protection Regulation, the Data Protection Directive before that. But a lot of emphasis in that was placed on the existence of human in the loop, and the idea that you're not just going to rely on the decision from the AI system, but you're going to have a human determine whether it is appropriate. That is an important guardrail, I would say. Having humans involved, having human-centered, human-led AI is important. But I think one of the big misconceptions we have, even at an individual level, is our ability to apply effective human oversight of these systems. At an individual level, we can overestimate our own discernment, but actually even more so at an organizational level, I think we can overestimate the motivation to fully actually review such decisions when people are overworked and pressed. And also, you just might have absence of training, the ability, and in this context in particular, the ability to be aware of how bias might emerge, because it doesn't always emerge in a an obvious manner. It can be in associated factors that create the bias. And so very close attention to how we provide governance to these systems is particularly important in these high stakes areas like policing, like employment, where the power balance is so against the individual. And I think it's particularly important to ensure people have transparency in those situations and the ability to actually question and challenge decisions in a meaningful way, which is no easy request, but I think it's essential.
And how can people, Maria, start to get that transparency, or where can we get that information and start to question things? Because I can suppose it can be quite difficult for people to, let's say, just put their voice out there, you know?
Well, so we have had for some time a limited ability to look into whether automated decisions are made about us under data protection law. And there is increased criteria for transparency in newer laws as well. But in terms of actually making it effective, I think one of the most important things is recognizing that the individual probably can't always effectively do this, doesn't have the skills or the tools. And so it has to come through third-party organizations, whether it's an adequately funded NGO or actually crucially supervisory authorities. And that supervisory authorities are effectively funded and enabled to have the power to properly scrutinize these types of practices and these types of decisions, and actually provide effective audits. And it's particularly important in these really sensitive areas public governance and in employment as well.
And I suppose creating that space for auditing, that space for questioning, that space for critically analysing how decisions are being made through AI is something that is still coming up in the Irish context. And I suppose people don't have that level of understanding or even trust with this whole AI generation and system that we're going into. That's an assumption I'm making, Abhi. But what do you think about the people's public trust in this sort of AI revolution that we're in?
Yeah, I think there is a mixed level of trust, but it's really difficult to assess. But one thing I was kind of constantly nodding my head as Maria was speaking about, you know, how individuals are given very little information and have very little leeway to actually scrutinize or question or demand better, because we're not really short of empirical evidence that show that AI systems, whether from the simple regression models to complex, systems like ChatGPT, systematically and inherently discriminate against, the marginalized, and the fact that, they tend to encode and sometimes exacerbate societal biases and so on. What you find even over the past few years is that we are regressing in a way because there is less and less transparency about models, you know, model architectures, how these models are trained, how they are evaluated and audited. Companies are sharing even less and less information. And now, you know, with generative AI becoming mainstream and everybody using it, the industry has a momentum selling these systems. And in, just to be clear, like generative systems, text generators like ChatGPT are inherently unreliable because they hallucinate. They can give you information that sounds accurate, but it's not accurate or it's non-existent. So because, you know, with generative AI becoming mainstream, the industry is on a momentum to really push AI into every space. And in fact, the industry is spending millions to ensure, you know, that there is positive understanding and positive reception of AI systems. As a result, what you hear is like a lot of what people know about AI or a lot of people's conception of AI comes from industry narratives, mostly from their marketing and PR team, that sells AI systems that don't actually perform as well in reality. You don't hear them talking about how their, you know, systems, you know, generative systems are inherently, you don't hear that, you know, hallucination is a feature, not a bug. But this kind of information is constantly buried. So,
and I suppose, like, it just sounds like it's a well-oiled machine, this sort of industry and people, the mass adaptation and mainstreaming of AI in general, inclusive of all the scariness, quite frankly, that it comes with, and the biases that it comes with. Maria, can people just opt out?
Well, I guess everything Abeba has said kind of shows you how you can't, of course. You know, if our governments are using it in their policing, if employers are using it in their hiring, you might be able to object in some limited sense, but opting out doesn't really seem to be an option. We have seen this increased pervasiveness of AI. So, you know, your simple Google search, you get the AI results first unless you disable that. You probably have Copilot on your work computer. You probably have some exposure to that in educational environment as well. And connecting that with the issue of trust is actually important as well, because it breeds familiarity in the same way most people using the facial ID on their phones when they want to pay. It breeds familiarity, which can actually feel quite close to trust. And regardless of any kind of surface level awareness we have that hallucinations exist, that we tend to just normalize the technology in a way that we just take what we see as the benefits and the potential risks get sidelined, and perhaps also get somewhat shamed as, you know, anti-AI, anti-progress, in a way that people might think as well, I don't want to put myself into that box. I don't want to be seen that way in my institution, in my workplace. I want to be seen as forward-looking and positive. And so it can actually be a social matter as well as a political.
And it's hard, and it's a fine line to kind of be at grips with, because it's like, especially from a social point of view, and you want to be seen as forward, but then on the back end of things, that we still need to critically look at how these AI systems in itself are replicating social inequalities, but also how it can be used as a tool to spread misinformation. I remember a couple of weeks ago, my grandmother, she sent me a text. It was a video of Elon Musk giving his life to Christ. And she was like, Elon Musk is a Christian now. I had to have the conversation. Grandma, this is AI. And she's like, what is AI? And I was like, Grandma, okay, let's sit down. So how is AI actually, it's not only just in itself creating hallucinations, it's not only itself replicating human biases, but how is it being used as a tool for misinformation too?
Yeah, great question. So yeah, it's important to, when we are talking about transparency or accountability or fairness, any of these big words, we tend to, you know, think of AI systems in and of itself as something that should be transparent or that should be held accountable. But we have to remember, there is no AI system independent of the humans. In fact, AI is human through and through and through, because, you know, the training data comes from humans. Training data also requires massive amount of work, cleaning, detoxifying, and so on, before it's ready to be fed into AI systems for training. even after you build AI systems, you need constant attention. You need constant steering. Even systems like ChatGPT, they require human attention. One way to steer them is through a method called reinforcement learning via human feedback. So humans are constantly involved in the AI system. So talking about AI without humans, whether it's helping humans helping build or whether humans, you know, financially substantiating it, because let's face it, the AI industry is, you know, it's the biggest financial industry, the biggest financial empire we have. So it really requires that, you know, looking at that financial and political economy behind it as well. There is research that looks at platform audits, that audits that evaluates platforms like TikTok, Meta, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and so on. And one of the most consistent findings here is that because of the business model of these platforms, that really encourages users to spend as much time as possible on that platform. They tend to kind of, you know, prioritize, they tend to put forward content that you think, you know, will capture your attention. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, misinformation or incorrect or disinformation or whether it's something super problematic. So as a result, you have, again, a massive body of research showing that platforms tend to a dissemination of misinformation, content that comes from white supremacist, the Nazi corner of the internet known as the manosphere. So this is kind of an area where you have all kinds of problematic ideology that is pushed into young boys and young girls, also here in Ireland. So it comes down to the business model of these platforms that really, you know, tries to capture people's attention for as long as possible. And as a result, you know, content that makes you outrage tends to get that attention. So as a result, you know, we end up with misinformation, disinformation.
And that's really difficult for especially a young person that may not have the critical thinking skills and these algorithms and the AI bots. These young people are kind of defenseless, especially towards it. And I suppose, Maria, yes, there are being audits, or there are organizations, NGOs that are trying to really hold these institutions and organizations accountable. But the everyday person, and for those who are even listening, that are questioning these AI systems, questioning where we're at in this reality, what can they start to do to ensure that they can maintain a healthy relationship with what's going on right now?
Well, I think what Abeba said there really highlights the point of critical faculties, and as you reiterate, and one of the things I think about most as an educator and, you know, with children of my own is about, well, how can the future generations, as you highlight, be able to maintain their critical faculties to be able to apply some discernment to what they are reading online and in other fora as well, and actually reflecting on the importance of actually reading and summarizing and interpreting and digesting and taking things slowly, which often will involve actually doing things with your own brain, I'm afraid, sometimes instead of the second brain, and emphasizing that alongside, you know, whatever use may be appropriate at times for you. But also, I think, very much emphasizing the importance that more is not better, and so much of what we are in this kind of post-commercialized LLM world is just AI slop, more content, more information, as opposed to actually applying a critical eye and going for authoritative, credible sources and taking the time to consume a smaller number of pieces of media ourselves and talking about them with other people, whether it's our children, our grannies, you know, who are confused by Elon Musk, and, you know, actually having human conversations, teachers and students, everyone should be talking more. And I think that is the best bulwark against, you know, apart from all the regulatory means we can adopt at that kind of personal relationship level. I think that's critical.
And it's super critical for us to start reflecting with our friends and family and have those critical conversations about what we are consuming, how we're engaging with AI, and how we're planning to use it in our everyday life. Well, thank you so much. That was Dr. Abeba Birhane of TCD and Dr. Maria Murphy of Maynooth University. Up next, we'll be talking to poet Nandi Jola. Stay with us. Welcome back to Unified. Now, joining me now on What's Your Story is poet Nandi Jola, an extraordinary voice for contemporary poetry and theatre. Born in South Africa and shaped in Northern Ireland, Nandi's work explores identity, migration, memory and belonging. She will run the New Irish Communities session with the Irish Writers' Centre later on this year. Welcome, Nandi.
Thank you so much for having me.
When it comes to your story, Nandi, can you tell us where it all began, how it got you into the world of the arts?
I just grew up in a household where my grandmother and my grandfather were very, I would say, ahead of their time. They were quite wealthy. And that was during apartheid. And it was very rare to see black people doing well and not working for anybody but themselves. They were so informed about their surroundings, and they knew that wealth was the way of, you know, getting ahead in life. And they built their wealth. And therefore, books, music, literature, storytelling was part of my everyday life, because we had people that were coming to work for my grandfather. And those people had stories of migration, of conflict, of, you know, everyday life. So I grew up in that household where I saw a lot of people on a daily basis. And I was so intrigued at the young age where I was listening to stories, but also orally listening to storytelling and poems. And I had access to a library at a time where libraries were being burnt down.
That is such a privileged position to be in, particularly in a time such as apartheid South Africa. And can I ask, how did it feel for your family to experience that?
One side of the coin, my father's side, they were not as privileged. They were quite poor, actually. My father was a bus driver, but he drove buses for the whites only as a black man. So he had an access to that world. And whenever he came home, he aspired for us, his children, to be educated, to access those spaces where there were libraries, there were parks, there were benches, and there were, you know, things that were quieter than on our side. So my father's side, as I said, was not as privileged as my mother's side. And therefore, we spent a lot of time at my mother's side, because we could see when we went over to my father's side how things could be if we didn't work hard enough or aspire enough to get out of the poverty trap. So I had a very early age a knowledge of both worlds, from my father's side and from my mother's side. And as I said, I knew that for me, education and literature was the way of getting myself not into poverty, but getting myself into the world, and writing and reading was the best thing for me to do as an individual, to tell my own story and to write it.
And that is beautiful. One thing my mother always says is when you educate a girl, you secure her future. So that education piece and that literature piece and knowing how to put your story into practice is a huge way that you have gotten into the world of poetry and art. And even moving into Ireland, can you let us know what was that process for you to move to Ireland with this knowledge, this, I like to say, cultural backpack in my work, with this cultural backpack of art, of creativity, and the context of South Africa as well?
Moving to Ireland was kind of, I didn't really understand the full context, political context, geographical context. It was for me more of a freedom, you know, post-apartheid 1994. We all wanted to get out, and whatever we wanted to get out of, remember, we had areas that we couldn't go to, the whites only spaces. And the first thing for me, I put it in my book. I wrote a piece of prose in there, From Home Is Neither Here Nor There, where I describe tasting things for the first time, you know, going to the cinema and watching things for the first time, going into those schools that I was not allowed to go to, just to taste what that normal life was. So it didn't even necessarily mean that you left South Africa just to go to another province or to go to another school that you are not allowed to by law, or, you know, interact with people that by law you are segregated from. And therefore, Ireland was just, I would say, a lucky straw for me in life to end up coming to a place of saints and scholars, where poetry and literature is taken so seriously And therefore, I didn't take it for granted. I took every opportunity that I could get. But the hardest thing was to remain true, to remain true to what I knew, the oral stories that I knew, and to find an audience that was receptive enough to those true stories of what it was like for me to grow up as a Black person, you know, under apartheid. But in Ireland, it was understood because Ireland was so familiar with the story of apartheid. They were anti-apartheid in that movement. But however, in Northern Ireland, that is contested because of our geopolitics, our affiliation to the UK. And therefore, I find being in south of Ireland and being in the north of Ireland, I would have different conversations because of people's affiliation to, you know, the UK or Ireland. And therefore, it's not easy navigating spaces in Ireland, depending on who you're talking to about colonialism and all of those things that happened during apartheid.
And how does it feel to navigate those spaces? I can imagine it may arise some emotions, particularly when you're talking with people who may have different viewpoints regarding that colonial history, both between South Africa and in Ireland as well.
I think the hardest thing for me, because I've lived, in Ireland or the north of Ireland, to be politically correct, for about 25 years, and I've come to understand that people, you know, on both or all sides of Ireland are hurting from the colonial legacy, because Ireland was also colonized by, you know, the Brits. And therefore, you find people who are sympathetic to you. You also find people who are defending. You also find propaganda. Like when I looked at the adverts on TV showing Africa as an impoverished continent, I was shocked and also upset, because that's not the Africa I know. If I was to flip the script, I would say it's, you know, it's being looted. And therefore, my work as a writer was to reflect that, that the Africa that I know has been under so much oppression, and therefore it doesn't give a voice to the African to tell their story. There's a saying or a proverb in Africa that says, you know, that until the hunted knows how to write their own story, it will always glorify the hunter. And that's exactly how I felt. So, you know, even just basic conversation, you understand that people didn't even have a true reflection of Africa. They would ask you in terms of Northern Ireland, how far is Nigeria from South Africa? I would be like, it's a continent, it's not a country. So it's quite far. And do you have McDonald's in Africa? The children would ask me when I do my workshops in school. And I'm thinking, my goodness, there isn't a positive image of Africa. Therefore, it became my work to go to schools and teach and show the positive aspect of Africa that I grew up under. And yes, there was troubles, but I wanted also to reflect that Africa is a diverse continent.
And I know you put this a lot in terms of your practice, your artistic practice and your work that you're engaging in creative writing as well with schools and with wider communities. How exactly do you, let's say, apply it so it resonates with the audiences that you're doing in terms of your artistic practice?
I mean, in terms of my artistic practice, diversity, you know, was a big thing. I have a poem, Arrivals, which is part of this year's Poetry Island. And Arrivals is not just about me, but it's about people who are born outside of Ireland, who arrive. And what is it that they see, feel, touch, and taste on a daily basis is different to what they are used to. And therefore, all your senses are trying to make sense of these spaces. And I think that's what resonates a lot with my writing, with migration, home, belonging, because a lot of Irish people have been everywhere. You know, they are here in South Africa, they are everywhere, the diaspora. So I think that's number one thing that we have in common, is this thing of traveling. We've always traveled, migrated elsewhere, like birds. We have birds that come from South Africa and they nest in Belfast. And there's a lot of connections in terms of names, place names in Ireland and both in South Africa. So I think that story is one of the universal story. The difficulty then of Ireland is then the legacy thereof. How do we talk, you know, about colonialism? How do we talk about conflict in a way that's inclusive without saying, but my conflict was worse than yours or yours was better than mine, you know, because at the end of the day, we all still carry that conflict. And in our writing, it is so obvious.
And it's really difficult to get people to talk about, let's say, colonialism and talk about the history that is shared, actually. And it's a shared history, and finding that commonality is so important. And I know you're doing a lot of work regarding it with your community activations and your community work in terms of creative writing, specifically those who are non-native and English speakers as well. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I want people to write their stories. And I keep saying, you know, when I came to Ireland, I was in my 20s. I had a spring in my step, and now I am mellow and I am sitting down and I am passing that knowledge down. So what is it that we can all do? I would say, even if you write your grocery list, what you buy on a daily basis, because I bet you any money, it's different to a native Irish person. We go to the African shops. What are the ingredients? Let's have those conversations. Where do we eat? What do we eat? Because it's different, right? And it can be shared. We can all have a long table and share from a cottage pie, fries, jello fries. You know, all of those things are important because that's what makes a community diverse. And that's exactly what these poetry classes are all about for me. They are about the people who have arrivals, as I call them, who have found a place to call home in Ireland. And we are having a conversation. So imagine these poetry classes as a long table where you bring something and we all share it.
That's beautiful. And that's the new Irish communities that was established in 2013 and by the Irish Writers' Centre. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Awesome. Awesome. And I suppose in terms of how you like to envision your work to support the future and our thinking surrounding issues such as migration, identity and belonging, what are your hopes in which your work will amplify this?
I mean, I'm hoping that it's already happening in the North, because we started these creative writing in the North. We started with Quotidien, working with Poetry Ireland. We established them. We did the Poetry Jukebox. We put poems in public spaces like the City Hall, Belfast, the Linen Hall, Belfast. And I was the curator. And they were in different languages. I speak Xhosa. They were in Xhosa, in Zulu, in Portuguese. So that language becomes, you know, because language is not just English or Irish, it's all the languages that we speak. And if we were to conduct a census of all the languages that are spoken on the island of Ireland, there would be over 2,000 languages. And therefore, I wanted literature to reflect that. There we had a couple of anthologies that I edited and we published. One is Trumpet, issue 14. And in those anthologies, people write in their languages. Mm. And I want, at least in my lifetime, to have created a whole series of these anthologies where people write about their experiences in their own native languages, so that we have a blueprint going forward, so that we can change the curriculum, we can change signage, where I am in South Africa, we have 11 languages and they're all official in the national curriculum, in public spaces. And I want Ireland to become one of those places that is so intercultural that it's not just Irish or English. It's more than that, because it will reflect the population.
And that's a way that we can actually move forward for people to understand that intersectionality and that wide diversity that Ireland currently has. And it's incredible to hear that your work is doing that. And I suppose as we move forward in terms of even how we discuss art, how we discuss identity, how we discuss belonging, the work that you're doing with these new communities is super essential for that. And I want to just ask you one final question. All of this goes back to storytelling. Why is storytelling so important to you?
Because it maps where we come from. It's our beginning. You know, in each story in Xhosa, we say, Tos, Tos. And that's exactly those two words, Tos, Tos, means from the beginning. So we can be in Ireland, but where are your roots? You know, what lineage are you? And in telling those stories, you are tracing them and the children and the children. My daughter's born in Antrim. She's Irish, my black Irish daughter, you know. And I always say, you know, we trace our lineage through stories because the senses are so powerful. We cannot underestimate how our senses will transport us back. And we listen to the words, we imagine them, because storytelling is imagining, isn't it? And it's reinventing, it's reimagining, it's retelling. And it's so diverse. You can just be in a place without setting your foot there. Just by listening to those stories, they will transport you there.
Well, thank you so much. That was poet, playwright and creative writing facilitator Nandi Jolai. And if you'd like to learn more about the New Irish Community's creative writing sessions with the Irish Writers' Centre, you could visit the irishwriterscentre.ie for details. Coming up after the break on the social scene, we'll hear about Dublin's new cycling club for the LGBTQ plus community and allies. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, cycling clubs are usually about fitness, fresh air, having a coffee with your friends, but it's also about finding connection and community. And a new Dublin group called the Gay Cycling Club is hoping to create that exactly. A welcoming space for people who love cycling and also a part of the LGBTQ plus community and allies alike. So now joining me on the show is organiser John O'Leary. Welcome, John.
Thanks very much indeed, and thank you for having me here today.
Brilliant. So tell me, where did the idea for the cycling club come out?
I've always had a passion for cycling, and I created this group on Meetup in 2022. And I created weekly or monthly cycles. 2024, I decided I wanted to connect and do something prior to Pride. So I organised a Pride cycle, and I had some people that came in cycled all the way from Wicklow. I cycled from Mahoney, and we all met at the Paper Cross, and we went for tea, coffee and sandwiches and cake in the tea rooms in the Phoenix Park. And it was, for me, it was a lovely way to connect and to gel with people who were keen cyclists but wanted to connect with their own community. Then, unfortunately, I got sick. I had a hip operation, and it fell in the background. But at the moment, I am very keen to get it reconnected, and my passion is to try and get the group established, put it out there. So I've been in touch with Cycling Ireland, with Sporting Prides. So for us, when we do have monthly cycles, we might cycle to Hoth, we might cycle to the Phoenix Park, but to give back to the community by arranging to have lunch, tea and coffee in Outhouse. And I think then for me, it's not as if we're going to be cycling 50 or 60 miles a day. It's just for people who have an interest in cycling to connect, to go out, who like the great outdoors.
And why particularly is this community and space, particularly for the LGBTQ plus community, why is that important? Because I know there's plenty of other cycling clubs out there, run clubs and things like that.
Every time I announce that there's a cycle, I get new members to come on board. It's in the early, but I have a passion. I want to see this grow. I want to see it go out there.
And is the club for experienced cyclers, or is it for complete newbies? Like, I know cycling is a big thing. You're talking about people coming from Wicklow to Dublin, and it's like, whoa, that could be daunting, yeah. No?
Well, the two ladies that came from Wicklow, they were members of a local group in Wicklow, and I was absolutely delighted to see them. They cycled on the tangents, basically, there was about six of us. It was very small, but it was lovely. It was a beautiful day, cycling to the Papal Cross. And it was just, for me, that we had different spots. We all meet up together. I had visions that there was going to be 150, 200 people on the cycle, but as it turns out, it was quite small, but it was lovely. It's for beginners. It's for people who are passionate for cycling. My goal is to set out a cycle, meet up, have a former committee, have regular meetups in regard to meetings, find out exactly where people want to cycle And let's say if they cycled the Greenway to Mullingar or along the canal, and it's all about the connection with members. It's all about connection with others. It's all about people who don't want to necessarily go to the pubs or go to the clubs, but meet up in a social aspect. There is that community, because there could be that person who's at home who is interested in cycling but is afraid to come out, who's afraid to come together, but now they're actually starting to come. And it's to tell people it's not set that you have to be an experienced cyclist.
And what does that connection or that space, what is the space you're trying to build, what does it actually do for people?
They're meeting their like-minded people. And what they're doing is they're creating friends. It's not going to be all about cycling. There will be a social aspect as well. I've organised and I've registered that we're going to be participating in Pride this year. So to go as a community, as a cycling group, to go to for dinner, that kind of thing, maybe go to Bord Gáis, maybe go and see Paul Ryder in one of his shows. That kind of connection with others, maybe go to the George to see one of the Shirley Temple doing her bingo on a Sunday night. But it's just that 4 hours out of, let's say, a Saturday or Sunday, you do your cycle. There will be as well, my plan is that we're going to have a midweek cycle, be it a Wednesday or Thursday, that there will be a cycle during the week, because not everyone is going to be free at the weekend. And to create that for people, if they want to go for a cycle midweek.
What is your favourite route to go on and why?
Well, for me, I love Howth. I love the Hill of Howth. There's so many different parts of Ireland. We're blessed with the weather. So one of the things I've looked at is maybe weekends away. But these are all creative ideas. So my plan on the 11th of July is to go with this group to launch it, to get it out there, to make people aware that we are there. We're not just exclusively for the LGBTQIA community. We are there for friends. So it's just to let people know that we're here. We're queer and we like cycling.
I love that. That's the phrase you should put on the... we're here, we're queer, we like cycling. And specifically, where can people get to be involved for those who want to dabble in cycling?
So basically, it's on meetup.com. It's called Gay Cycling Club. Follow the social media.
Fantastic to hear. So thank you so much, John. Folks,
thank
that's
you
John
very
O'Leary
much indeed.
From the Gay Cycling Club there. And that brings us to the end of the show, folks, on Unified, supported by Commission a Man. Catch us on podcast on the Go Loud app or every Sunday on News Talk at 8 p.m. Goodbye for now.